This is Catherine Madden, December 13th, 2013. The lecture is entitled From Chaos to Creative Ritual in Life Transitions. This was recorded on DVD, and there were just a few diagrams written on a flip chart, and the DVD is in the library at the Jung Society.
Welcome, everybody. Can you hear me? Well, I think that Catherine and I met, if I'm not mistaken, through our LinkedIn group. Is that right, Catherine? Yeah. And so since then, we have first of all, I'll say we do have this wonderful virtual world out there, and we have a LinkedIn group and a Facebook group. And the LinkedIn group has almost 600 people from all over the world now. And so it's really a wonderful place to be online where we have some really great discussions and resources are shared and so on. So if you want to join us, it's called the C.G. Jung Seattle Group.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Catherine Madden is a psychoanalyst of Jungian orientation in private practice in New York City. And she told me that she loves New York, but it's also a good place to leave and go back to. And she's an author of A Dark Night of the Soul and co-editor of the Encyclopedia of Psychology and Religion. She's also the senior editor of Quadrant. She's quite the busy woman and is on the adjunct faculty at Pacifica Graduate Institute. She's a lecturer in depth psychology and comparative spirituality at Union Theological Seminary. Her forthcoming book is entitled The Vanquishing Point, and she continues to lecture internationally, and she's here with us tonight. Please welcome Catherine Madden.
Thank you, Mary Ellis. That was lovely. And always when I hear myself introduced, I go, do I really do that much? Oh, I guess I do. Well, as you know, tonight we'll be discussing from chaos to creative ritual and life transitions. And I think what I've thought we might do is two parts, because I know what it's like for me to sit for 2 hours. So I think I'm going to do part one, so to speak, and go through that, and then we'll have a little break. There's some delicious-looking green frosted cookies out there, if they're not already yummied up. And then we'll start quite a different portion. I should say that the initial portion is a little bit more narrative story, a little bit more about liminality itself. And then the second portion is more about postmodern structures and cultural aspects, if liminality is working in our world, what it might mean. It's a little bit different. So you might have favorite portions, and that's okay. So now I'm going to start out with a quote. We'll see if anybody recognizes this. Whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. Ah, all right, bravo. Very good. Ishmael, of course. Moby Dick by Herman Melville. When my husband, I'm going to start out with a story, was 19 years old, he had the opportunity to crew on a relatively small boat that sailed across the Pacific from Hawaii to San Francisco. Now, how small a boat do you ask? Well, it was 38 feet long. For those of you who know about boats, that's not real big. And that's a pretty small boat when measured against the vastness of the Pacific. How did this come about? Well, he, and of course I have permission, since he's my husband, to tell this story. It's not like a client. He had a difficult time in his junior year at Colgate, and this difficulty was a combination of being emotionally stressed over the competitiveness of the school environment, as well as, some of you I know in this room will remember, the social upheaval of those years of civil rights struggles, the Vietnam War, and campus protests. Trying to grow up, he felt as if he was falling apart. His inner life was chaos, and I'm going to be doing some keywords here. Chaos of competing emotions and thoughts. He was no longer just the teenager who excelled academically and athletically in high school, but he hadn't made a mark in college, nor did he had any idea what he wanted to do as an anthropology major. He was in the stage of what we called betwixt and between, the liminal state, which occurs in most life transitions. Well, feeling out of sorts, Ron sought counseling on campus, and he didn't find it to be of much help. And he came away feeling as if this wasn't the answer. He seemed so depressed when he came home for spring break that his parents offered him the opportunity to take a little trip and get a change of scenery for the summer that might help him to get back on solid ground. It was, after all, for him, a damp, dreary November in his soul. He was able to travel to Hawaii that summer, the summer of 1969, for a much-needed break. That's what got him 6,000 miles from home on a small piece of land in the middle of the largest body of water on Earth, symbolic, perhaps, of the state of his inner life at the time, isolated, surrounded by great unknown on all sides. So then, what got him on this small boat, other than a naive fearlessness, you may ask? Well, on a practical level, okay, he had to vacate a room that he was renting in a small house in Honolulu because it was being sold, and not wanting to return home because the summer wasn't over yet, he and a new friend he had met on the island, who was also between his junior and senior years, went down to the docks and found a sailboat returning to the mainland on which they could crew in exchange for free transport. So that's the practical level. But on a deeper level, he longed for an adventure. Perhaps something was moving in his psyche to lead him to a rite of passage in adulthood, or at least to help him to find a unique identity. He desperately wanted an experience that he could call his own, that would help define and maybe transform him. More about Ron's rite of passage in his sea voyage later, but for now I'd like to turn to an example of another transitory liminal time that I'm sure most of us are familiar with, but I'm just going to flesh it out a little bit more. And this one, of course, is from the life of Carl Jung. Since he wrote about it in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, it is well known that Jung went through an extended period of depression or melancholy, following his break with his then-mentor, Sigmund Freud. But I personally would call this, in my own perspective, not a depression, or not a melancholy, or not a schizophrenic break, as so many clinicians have done. I call this a creative depression, and I've written about this. Jung himself called it his Nikea, or Night Sea Journey. He said following the break with Freud that a period of inner uncertainty began for me. It would be no exaggeration to call it a state of transition, a state of disorientation. I felt totally suspended in midair, for I had not yet found my own footing. Around this time, Jung, who loved to sail, invited some friends to take a four-day sail with him on Lake Zurich. And during this voyage, One of his friends began to read aloud the Nikea episode of Homer's Odyssey, The Journey of Ulysses, to the Sojourn of the Dead. Cheery title. The episode on Lake Zurich was noteworthy for Jung in that he soon embarked on a period of his life that he likened to his own journey to the underworld. Images and dreams pounded forth with an autonomy that provoked an internal conflict sufficient enough to cause him to step down from his academic position. Von Frauen says that the unconscious has its own ways of revealing what is destined in a human life just at that time when it is ready to be integrated. And I want to say that again because I think that's a really important thought. The unconscious has its own way of revealing what is destined in a human life just at a time when it's about to be integrated. Truly, the unconscious was revealing itself to Jung, and he relinquished himself to the pull of these inner contents, not knowing to what ends they would lead him. A long period of self-analysis ensued, which most of us are familiar with, during which time Jung, to remain with the nautical imagery for the time being, remained on ship, but no longer as its captain. Creative play helped him to establish some calm, but in the long run, something erupted, which he says he found difficult to control. Slowly, the waves of inner tension mounted until he found that he stood helpless before an alien world. With unceasing intensity, the floodgates finally gave way, but not without some willingness on Jung's part. In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, Jung describes the very moment. Then I let myself drop. Suddenly, it was though the ground literally gave way beneath my feet, and I plunged down into dark depths. That's in MDR, page 179, for those of you who would like to look things up. And I'll do that occasionally if folks like that. In later episodes, which we might also call the pull of liminality, attempts to get to the very bottom, Jung said, I found myself at the edge of a cosmic abyss. It was like a descent into empty space. And I had the feeling that I was in the land of the dead, this recurring image of dead. But I think I'll say later more, but symbolically, we're treating that symbolically, of course. Yet, while all of this may have capsized many an ordinary psyche, Jung discovered within himself a strength to endure the torrential undercurrents of the unconscious, a strength which was fueled by a voracious hunger for understanding what was also coupled with an unswerving conviction that he was obeying a higher will. And that will become an important point when we speak more specifically to liminality. Reflecting on this period much later in life, he recalled the significance of his inner journey, this Nikea, to the development of his own work, saying, the years when I was pursuing my inner images were the most important in my life. In them, everything essential was discovered. It was the prima materia for my life's work. Moving now to the characteristics of liminality, specifically. And I'm sure you're familiar with some of these because you've experienced them, but I do want to speak to them concretely before we move on. So there are several definitions to the word liminal in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, and I think the one most germane for our purposes is relating to or being in an intermediate state, phase, or condition. Relating to or being in an intermediate state, or condition, in between, transition, the liminal state between life and death. There we get that life and death emphasis again. British cultural anthropologist Victor Turner says that persons that occupy liminal status in a society can be found in its margins or occupy its lower rungs. I'm not sure I agree with that, but that's what he said. And yet the whole purpose of the liminal state is transitional from the old status to a new status, from a girl to a woman, from a boy to a man. They are neophytes, which have not yet become what they are destined to be. They are in the betwixt and between. Liminality has to do with a stage of transition that we go in and out of at various times in our life. It's a state of being between stasis and growth. Now, I mentioned chaos in my title because liminality often immerses us into states of being which feel like chaos, or it may be seen as antidotal to chaotic breakdown. Think about the stories with which I began about my husband and Carl Jung. Some of the specific characteristics, and you heard me kind of emphasizing those in the stories. We feel suspended in the unknown. We lose our persona, and I will add later something about the ego. We don't feel like our usual selves. We're detached from our former status, but we haven't achieved a new status as of yet. And of course, this promotes a feeling of ambiguity because we feel both in and out of time. So I call this a phase of waiting in. In traditional rituals of liminality, the subject is cut off from his or her normal contacts, their known communities, families, or support networks. And I'll ask us to think later on, just a hint, about how we achieve or don't achieve that in our current society. Often the individual undergoing a stage of liminality is disguised, masked, camouflaged, covered with amulets, designs on the body. I think of some of our contemporary tattooing, you know, the tattooing earrings. We're, you know, rather miraculously and glamorously decorated with earrings. But the whole idea is that the status and personal property of the initiate is relinquished. So guess what? During the stage of liminality, all the earrings go. Can't get rid of the tattoos, but that's not the point. Think here of the initiate in the military undergoing the rite of passage known as basic training. Now, I wouldn't be able to make it through it, but authority becomes an issue, right? One no longer has any. Usually there are instructions from a group of ritual elders that the subject is to behave passively or with humility. If there is more than one individual engaged, which we certainly find in boot camp, we find that intense bonds of alliance form between those in the betwixt and between ritual. We can think of numerous other examples that apply at least to some of the above characteristics. The first day of grade school, leaving home to go to college. Perhaps we entered a training program in the very liminal phase of midlife crisis and suddenly found ourselves by a group of ritual elders to whom we had to suddenly become humble students once again, perhaps in our late 30s or 40s, which definitely evokes a feeling of transference. Often there might be an accompanying element of crisis to liminality. Think of the epidemic of job loss that we are so familiar with in our economy when the economy bottoms out. There are phases of liminality all the way through the passages of the life cycle, both for parents and for children, infancy, pubescence. The Empty Nest, Becoming a Grandparent, Going Through a Divorce, Losing a Partner to Death, Dating Again for the First Time with One Whom Has Met on One of These Cyberspace Matchmaking Services. There are numerous phases of liminality in corporate life. Transitions in job levels, corporation mergers and acquisitions. I have a colleague right now who has been in HR for about 30 years of her life, and suddenly someone else has her position. And she's definitely in a stage of liminality, not knowing where she will be, what she will be. I want to mention two forms of liminality because these are going to pertain all the way throughout. They're important to note because of how change occurs in one and not in the other, or if it does occur, not in the same way. The first is what I'll call ceremonial ritual, and the second is transformational ritual. In ceremonial ritual, we emerge from the induced chaos of the liminal phase, but we're still confirming the values of the status quo. In fact, we're actually celebrating them, right? Think of national secular celebrations, President's Day, Memorial Day, Independence Day. Now, these are all great holidays and great celebrations, but I found it interesting to think about them in terms of days of remembrance, to recommit to the ideals represented by our country and our value systems, but nothing about these celebrations is designed to change the status quo. That doesn't make them bad, but they're not designed to change. So that's one form of liminality. Well, unless you count getting a good deal on a mattress or a new car as transformative. Okay, perhaps it is. So in essence, with ceremonial ritual, the status quo has been affirmed. Nothing has changed. The second form of ritual, however, is transformational. Characteristics involve deconstruction and reconstruction, with a container, important, that holds these opposites together while they undergo the impact of emerging imagery and symbol. Imagery is going to be a key word. For those of you coming to the workshop tomorrow, just a little plug on that. We'll be working a great deal with imagery, dreams, symbols, ritual, etc. So I hope you all dream tonight. And if you don't, that's okay. We'll have plenty of time. Symbol is central here. The reason a ceremonial ritual might not succeed is for the very purpose that our images do not move to a deeper symbolic level. In other words, we are still caught up in our own images. Now, there's nothing wrong with our own images. It's just when images work and continue to, whether it's amplification, association, whatever form you choose to work with imagery, they usually evolve over time, and whatever that time is, it's different for each one of us, but it usually evolves in our communitas or our community groups, in our own work on individuation and analysis, into a symbol. And remember, a symbol carries opposites. So the point is, we see an important step in emerging from a ritual of liminality in terms of transformation, transformative ritual. And some rituals contain elements of both ceremony and transformation. For example, this can be seen in The Vision Quest. We've had some wonderful movies on The Vision Quest, which I simply adore. Or the Aboriginal tradition of the walkabout, What was that movie recently? Oh, it was just, I've seen it twice. I'm terrible with film names. The young person is learning the traditions. He has the grandfather who lives on the high mountaintop and is doing the old shamanic rituals, and there's just this little young boy. Oh, it's the one with Nicole, Australia, with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman, right? But I'm far more interested, actually, in the grandfather and the little boy. It's a beautiful story. And the young person is learning the traditions of the tribe by going on a journey. He has some ambivalence about when he's ready to go on this journey. But he finally does. He finally relinquishes himself to go with his grandfather, which we might call a hero's journey. And I'm going to be discussing that in the second half of our time tonight. He will return with a new name, very possibly, a new identity, a new worldview, and the experience will have transformed him to be welcomed into his tribe of persons anew, no longer as a child, but with all of the status, rights, values, and responsibilities of an adult man or woman. This ritual of liminality transforms a person. However, it does not transform the community. So there's kind of a mixture here. In fact, to the contrary, it upholds and renews the community and its living tradition. It preserves, again, the status quo at the societal or communal level. Now, there's no judgment here. We're not judging this. We're just distinguishing between the two types. I have a cat who does a walk about every morning about 4 a.m. And I just had to throw this in because this has been a recent thing. He's 16 and a half, and he starts at the feet and crawls very carefully all the way up to the, looking over the covers and into my face, to make sure it's still me. and then he'll jump down and he'll repeat this walkabout, I call it the walkabout because I'm so charmed by it, about 10 times. And whatever, it doesn't affect any change in me other than getting up to feed him. So this ritual is not about change, it's just about feeding his gullet, an empty stomach needing to be filled. I imagine some of you have cats and dogs that do that too. I just hope the dogs aren't too big. Now, I also want to mention types of rituals, two more, in terms of life crisis and affliction. Now, these emerge from Victor Turner's work with the Ndembu peoples in Africa, but I think they equally pertain to more modern things that Jung speaks of, and I'll make those analogies. Life crisis rituals deal with the various transitional phases, birth, puberty, marriage, death, and of course the ever familiar midlife. Rituals of affliction capture us by what indigenous peoples in Africa call ancestral shades. I love that. Ancestral shades. Shades are spirits of the dead. Rings a bell, doesn't it? If you think back on the Red Book and the MDR, where Jung is speaking so much about the call of the dead of Jerusalem, they come, there's a clanging of a bell, and they are there. They have come to him, they have called him, they have pulled him into their world from the unconscious. An interesting point that we might consider for our own culture is that when one is inflicted with an infliction by an ancestral shade, and I think in Jungian terms we can think about this as analogous to our individual complexes. And as we know, our individual complexes are always hooked to an archetype. They're always hooked to an archetype. And we don't just necessarily have one complex. We can have numerous complexes. And the whole idea is that we eventually want our complexes to not have us, but to us have them, and they're more in orbit around us. Not that they're not still hooked to the archetype, but that they're not controlling us, because we end up with great fields of projection, which again will be somewhat of my second half. This is a major point in depth psychology, which in the business we call psychic infection. Because not only is the individual infected, and I'm not sure how much we often notice this, those of us who are in groups, societies, Jungian groups, any kind of groups, faculties, reading book groups, church groups, synagogue groups, whatever kind of groups you're in, I think that because the unconscious is unconscious, we're not always aware of how one person's psychic infection, so to speak, or psychic infliction can actually seep around and have kind of an insidious effect upon the whole community. And we may feel that as a mood, and we don't know why. And obviously we don't want to blame anybody, but another point is that we do want to find a way, hopefully in the future, of working this out for some very serious reasons. One person's malady has to do with the obvious shadow material. And remember, with the shadow, we have two polarities. There's the negative shadow, and there's very positive grist to the shadow, just as there's the negative animus and the positive animus. We can have positive or negative animus possession, negative anima possession, where it has us. Again, there's your complex. Or we can work through some of the various stages. And Jung's stages are a little rigid, as we know, in this sense. He'll go four stages. I think we've gone farther than that. We've spread it out, and we've given that a little bit more depth. We're working with this in depth psychology now as cultural complexes. I'm sure you're aware of some of the books out, Singer and others. In Africa, these rituals of affliction have more to do with something curative for illness. And I want to point out the difference here is that whole villages participate in these rituals. A question I want to raise, and I'm going to have a little question time and then a break. A question I want to raise for discussion, along with any other comments you have and questions, is do we find analogies in our own culture in that we are so split from our own villages of origin and other obstacles? And how does this fact affect the potential for transformative liminality? Does anybody want me to repeat that, or is that pretty clear? Repeat it? Okay. I'm raising the question. Analogies in our own culture, in that we are so split from our own villages, so to speak, of origin and other obstacles, which I'm sure you will name, how does this fact affect our potential for transformative liminality? Which, of course, affects change. This is crucial. This is crucial on so many levels, which we'll get to. So, it's 20 of 8. Let's have 15 minutes of question and then a break, and then we'll be on to section 2. And feel free to ask anything or clarification on anything. Yes?
So what term do you use for, there's kind of the status quo, and then there's the liminality, and then there's the new status quo. What term do you use for whatever event or what takes place between the status, shifting from the status quo to the liminality? You know, like there's a, there's a shifting point. What do you refer to that as?
From, let's say, the more the celebration, you're saying, where one goes back to the status quo and into a transformative?
No, actually, from the first status quo into the in between. You know, whether it's Freud dumps Jung, or you go into basic training, or what do you call that? An onset event, or I don't know what. That's what I'm wondering.
I would call it, well, for Jung, a crisis event that set him into a creative depression. He doesn't recommend that for everyone. He says so because you can go into inflation or deflation, and we need to really, ironically, beef up our egos, although I'm going to be speaking to the contrary in the second half about ego. But we really need to beef up our strength and our egos to be able to relinquish them.
In terms of whatever transitional space we go, as we go through this transition from point A to point B, boy to man, and so on and so forth, there is this transitional piece which the psychotic loses touch with reality. So where does the sense of coherence, which ties the two together, come in?
With psychosis?
No, well, here, you know, the mystic, mm-hmm. you know, swims in what the psychotic drowns in. So when we're looking at the Nietzsche journey of Jung and so on, he came through this with a sense of coherence to become what he was to be. But the psychotic just disintegrates. So there seems to be a thread or a sense of coherence that one needs to find.
The difference, I would say, is the ego, again, in this sense. Arguably, some people feel differently. As I mentioned, I believe that Jung had a strong, barely in some respects, a strong enough ego and willingly wanted to take the dive. In fact, he consciously sought to jump into the unconscious, whereas the psychotic person, and I'll talk a little bit about that in terms of culture too, doesn't have that ego, or to varying degrees, because there are different levels of psychosis. A high-functioning bipolar person, you know, it's they'll have some ego to do some of this thread. Others will have nothing. It's like being surrounded by a constant sea of chaos, of imagery that doesn't cohere. And for Jung too, a lot of it didn't cohere. When the floods and the rivers of blood came before World War I, he wasn't totally aware of what that meant. I mean, it took time. It was shocking to understand that. But that became that process of active imagination and amplification to try to get a sense on what these messages, what the secret message was that was being given to this stage that I would call a form of liminality.
I'm really interested in what you were starting to say about this, a split off from the village, our village, and what that might mean for our individual development in those liminal states we find ourselves in. Could you say more about what you're thinking about that?
I'm going to say a lot in the second section, but could you repeat? I couldn't quite hear the last section.
Well, I'm really interested in where I think you were going with this idea of splitting off from our village, with I guess a big V, culturally, and how that affects our individual development in those states of liminality we find ourselves in. I found myself going to my own periods of liminality and thinking about just briefly what that split off from the village or the community and our cultural stance in large part that individuals we have to stand on our own as individuals and And we moved away from our ancestors. We moved away from the big village, the all that information that we can have, but we negate. So it brought up a lot for me just from what you said briefly. Mm-hmm. Like, what more is there? So
I think there's a lot more, and I'll mention some of it in the state of crisis that I is my point of view in that I believe our world is in because of some of these factors. I guess I'm not using the mic, so I should use the mic. For whatever reason, I mean, because you think of the important states of separation is one thing from the village. Isolation is another step that's important, whether it be to go on the walkabout or the vision quest. But there's always a reincorporation or a reaggregation of the person back to a community. Now, we do have some of that. I mean, we do have in our culture, I think, I'm sure many of you can name a number of entities that still provide that. But I'm wondering if we have enough based on some of the other world events that are occurring. And what might we think of that would be creative? And again, I think it goes back to the symbol. Some of the indigenous peoples, you see, they had the symbol. Just one example of it's called the milk tree ritual for a pubescent girl in the Ndumbu tribe. It was rather frightening. She was taken at her time when, you know, a woman passes into that new phase of the moon, and she was naked and wrapped in a hand-woven blanket from one of the women of the village. And she was moved out to about a mile away from the village. There was what was called the milk tree. And it was called a milk tree because it weeped milk, a kind of sappy milk, which was reminiscent of the feminine. And she was left out there. And there's some cold nights in Africa and beasts of prey. And nobody came. The elders all went home. She was left out there to endure the shades, the dreams, the feelings, the terror. There was no one, at that point, no one to comfort her. But when the ritual was over, she did have, and the symbol of the great tree with the roots going down into the ground, and it had been there for who knows how many years. May still exist today. I don't know that. To go back to, and once the ritual is over, of course, there was dancing, there was celebration. The rituals began with dancing, and before they sent the person off on a rite of passage, and ended with celebration. And women from all the other villages would come, and there was, I won't go into all of it, but they would come with a wooden spoon. And everybody, and they would give the young woman the wooden spoon, and she would be the first to dip into some product of food that they would all put together. And so she was raised to a new status, and most often given a new name or a new imprint or something. So there was the village to return to and a symbol to return to. That's what I'm questioning. Do we still have, and what difference that makes?
I just want to say that currently with what's happening in South Africa with the loss of a great leader, and what's happening is dance. What's happening is a celebration in that community. And I've been hearing on the news quite a bit of talk about why that's happening, that it's so important to the community to dance. It's so mm-hmm. important to celebrate, not to grieve, but to move forward. To, mm-hmm. yeah, so. Mm-hmm. I think that also speaks to it. saying it.
Yeah, I think there can be a celebration of life and death. I hear many services being named these days a celebration of life when someone passes. And it's a whole different slant on how we look at that.
Well, first of all, I love your question. And just driving here tonight in a five-minute clip on NPR, I was profoundly struck with the essence of your question, which is the incredible wound of the missing village, the wounded village, the broken village, the translocated village, nobody home in the village, with a story of a town in America where apparently the shooting rates are up to 3 per day. And I was taking that in as an adult, barely able to breathe, you know, even though we've all become so presented with that every day, you know, hit with it on all sides. And when the young adolescent voice came on, I could barely keep my composure. You know, the profound tragedy of a 13-year-old saying, in complete innocence, how do I go to school? Just a simple thing like that, let alone breathe. How do I go to school every day? Not even mention and be safe. And what happened for me as a now senior citizen and somebody who has dedicated my life to death psychology, I was struck with what even we have to do as elders to keep up with it. You know, where to intervene now, because I was struck with the effect on our precious human body and in particular the heart. So just two things, 30 years apart. When I heard my first drive-by shooting, I remember our whole culture was talking about for weeks. For weeks. Mm-hmm. We were struck, we were wounded, we were talking to each other. And now, at least those of us who are not practicing psychic numbing, which is quite easy to do, it's a nonstop assault. And so your question is so huge. I'm struck with the broken village everywhere. And I think what I put my most hope in is us adults and elders opening up this conversation for real. For example, why are we all in so much pain? And then last comment, I'll just state that, you know, because of Mandela's death, it had such a temporal crossover with the 50-year anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. I'm struck with the fact that I think we are stuck profoundly, deeply, and I hope not irrevocably, on the loss of our innocence. And then I submit to all of us that we've never even opened up that question. What happened to our innocence? And the legacy of passing that on into generations. And just pick a system and go. Education, endless war, the economy, pick a system and go. So all I know now is the sanctity of the human heart and the capacity for us to all find our voice on things that matter. And I hope we stand together, because for me, there's nothing left. Yeah, seriously, I love your question.
I can't top that. I'm very moved by that. So I think it's time for us to take our break. I have 5 of 8, is that right? Let's meet back at 10 after 8. Thank you. All right, now we're going to change gears, and this is going to be a little bit different. And please, if you have questions in between, feel free to stop me and ask them. It's we're moving into some kind of, well, I think, intense material following from the idea of liminality and how it pertains to our world. I use the word postmodern, but I don't even know post-postmodern. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So our world today is enough to say. Postmodern studies claims that Jung moved toward the problem of the modern ego, but left off with an ambivalent stance toward the heroic ego. Instead, he left us with the ego as subject to a less threatening form of the unconscious. I think that this pertains to how we understand or participate in liminality in contemporary society. And I'll be unpacking all this all the way along. In other words, the modern ego conquers the unconscious. Say, for example, on our version of vision quests and walkabouts, and although transformed, the ego never undergoes the process of transformation or full surrender that is necessary to the transformative elements of liminality. We remain stuck at the level of ceremonial change instead of transformative change, which is kind of my thesis running through here, red thread. In extreme, what could be a liminal experience becomes more, here's a little bit different twist, more of an inflation for the ego than a surrender. Now, let me unpack that. Certainly, we see instances of such inflation and delusion on all levels of global existence. Yet, are these cracks and fissures in our global fabric, our politics, our environmental destruction, our ideological and religious fundamentalisms, a matter of displacement of the ego into mysticism, metaphysics, or the mythological? Or are they a displacement of the modern ego, an ego that is constructed by modern civilization? Or are we failing to clearly define, live, and maintain our Jungian identity through a more thorough embrace of liminality? I think we've begun to address that in the first section. And thus, are we contributing to a failure to individuate? Because really, individuation would, I would argue, would involve the transformative aspect of liminality. Jung broke new ground in emphasizing the relativization of the ego. And what I mean by that, as I'll explain in the various self-ego diagrams, but the relativization of the ego, meaning in this self-ego axis, that the ego is pushed aside to be in line with the self. So he emphasized the relativization of the ego as a crucial aspect of the individuation process, leading toward consciousness of human totality. Fissures and fault lines occur when the ego-self relationship becomes embedded in too metaphysical or too mythological a language, but also when the symbolic dimension is replaced by an overinflated ego and synthetic global realities that mimic ego-self relationship. I'm interested here to look briefly at where we are in terms of the modern Western ego and to discuss how our more secular emphasis on ceremonial change in contrast to transformational change inhibits us from achieving wholeness. Or further wholeness. I don't believe there's any such thing as wholeness, but further wholeness. Specifically, I'll be comparing some of the stages of emergent consciousness that Edinger called self-ego access, what Jung referred to as the ego-self relationship. And if you can see that with my sketchy diagram there, that is the in Edinger's Ego and Archetype, I have the page number somewhere here. No, I don't. Anyway, you're right, it's an ego archetype. So At the same time, I'd like to look at the collective relationship between ego and self in the notion of the hero myth, its potential for overinflation, and the more extreme dilemma of association from the self. In our time, and remember the self now, I want to go back to that notion in liminality of a transcendent factor, and maybe for us in a Jungian world, since we're speaking of psychology, I'm not trying to move over or separate the fields of religion or spirituality from psychology. We're in psychology, we're not trying to speak about God, or that's not our realm. I mean, we can say that the self points beyond itself, but we're really, I was taught not to cross those boundaries. So for us, the self is a representation of potential totality. I'll name some of the contributing factors, but point more to the potential urgency of what has been identified, and this is a scary word, as an apocalyptic outcome. Now, I don't mean that in the way that I'm sure you've heard a lot of people say that. I don't mean that, you know, something's going to come down and erase us all and all that. Forget all that. I will touch upon the notion of apocalypse as both a literal reality of global demise and, most importantly, as a symbolic reality. The emphasis on symbolic reality is meant to highlight the importance of liminality and our ultimate responsibility in becoming ever more responsible and aware of the nature of the collective unconscious. Drawing from Jungian analyst Edward Edinger's stages of ego self-development, he talked, and I didn't put them all up here because you're familiar with most of them, I think. The first one was Ouroboric, and everybody remembers this, the snake chasing the tail. It's basically an undifferentiated state. Could kind of think of some of the neophytes back in the liminal phases. They're in an undifferentiated state. The second was the emerging ego primarily identified with the self. And that's natural. I mean, we get excited, we identify. There's nothing wrong with projective identification. If it is a teacher or someone we really appreciate, a professor, a writer, there's nothing wrong with projective identification as long as it doesn't stay there. It needs to move on. Third, a more advanced state of development, with some ego self-identity remaining, we note that the ego self-axis has become partially conscious, and that four is an ideal theoretical stage in which, well, it mostly likely doesn't exist. As I say, I don't think there is a complete totality in which there's total separation of ego and self and a complete consciousness of the ego self-axis. So what I have here is stage three. We see that the...
You see here that the ego is sharing. It's got a bridge with the self, this bridge with the self here. But it's not merged. There's some identification, but there's no merger. It's a participatory relationship. Here, we have the ego in a more of a separate state, but it's still in alignment, but this is a more individuated state. It's still related. It's never separate. And that's going to be very different from what I'm going to speak about in a minute.
So in Edinger's stage 3 and 4 diagrams, the shaded areas designate the residual ego self-identity. The dotted line connecting ego center with self represents the ego self-axis, the vital connecting link between ego and self that ensures the integrity of the ego, for one. Now, there are numerous diagrams of ego self-alliance, but I'd like to focus just on two. And the other one I found in a colleague of mine, Jerome Bernstein's book entitled Living in the Borderland, in which he claims that the modern Western ego is undergoing, what I've spoken of earlier, an overinflation and dissociation.
those of you who've studied family systems or genograms, it's kind of a divorce line here. The lines of divorce. We've got an ego, and actually, in his diagram, the ego is a little bit larger than the ego in Edinger's diagram. It's a little bit plumper. And I have some questions about that. So this is in Bernstein's book, Borderline, Living in the Borderline.
What was the second word, the gram? Something gram?
Grand.
Genogram.
Genogram.
Genogram. A genogram is used a lot in family systems. It's a fascinating tool where you go back. First, you establish your own family history, and you can do it according to spirituality, addictive patterns, divorce patterns, any kind of patterns. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but relationships that are kind of squiggly, not too cool. And see, the main thing is to see the patterns. And it's, let me just tell you, the first time I ever did it, I thought, oh, I'm just going to be drawing a big diagram on our dining room table here with my husband. And it is very powerful. It's a very powerful tool. So Bernstein describes a diminishing of self, ego self dialogue over the past 50 years due to the growth of an overinflated ego and power complexes. He finds that the evolution of the rational mind, the logos, has grown way out of proportion and has become a primary instrument of power to dominate the world. We've become so consumed with power complexes that we've let go of the imaginal and the liminal as a more prominent dialogue with the transpersonal element of the self. Instead, we've developed an overly magnified, what he calls, organ of the psyche, which in essence threatens its own survival. In fact, our survival. Along with the environment of this planet. Our moral and spiritual tradition, and these are Jung's words from CW18, both these quotes, our moral and spiritual tradition has collapsed and left a worldwide disorientation and dissociation. Our immediate communication with nature is gone forever. Well, I hope we can prove Jung wrong. Yeah, that's a little scary. This last citation from Jung underscores Bernstein's solution to this diminished dialogue as a return to the state of participation mystique. Back in the animistic cultures, you know, where we were part of the rocks and the mountains, especially the indigenous persons that were colonized in our own country, with nature, and what he calls, it's kind of a big term, a co-evolutionary participation of the ego with the self. And before I speak of what that means, I'd like to just say a few things about inflation. There are positive and negative aspects of inflation, believe it or not. Primarily, whether positive or negative, it's a symptom of psychological possession. Inflation is a regression of consciousness into unconsciousness. This happens when consciousness takes too many unconscious contents upon itself and loses its faculty of discrimination. So again, we have an emphasis on the modern ego missing, and this is as far as I've gone with this, this is obviously a project I'm working on, missing the necessary surrender, periods of isolation, reintegration involving liminality, and back to our idea of villages. So, the bridge to the self that Edinger calls the ego self-access begins to disappear. To go one step further, I'd like us to take a look at Bernstein's diagram and to propose that perhaps in his naming of the separation of ego and self as overinflation and dissociation, we may be dealing, and somebody brought this up, we may be dealing with a certain type of psychosis on a collective level. Psychosis, defined, is an extreme dissociation of the personality due to the activity of unconscious complexes and the phenomenon of splitting. If splitting reaches the organic structure, then the dissociation becomes a psychosis in which each complex is living an existence of its own. Back to the village idea. Living an existence of its own. What's happening? There is no personality, no ego left to tie them together. That's a quote from Jung, CW18 again. This is very much the kind of splitting that Bernstein is speaking to in our dissociation from nature and the environment. Recall in Liminality how cultures have deemed that even the plants and vegetation have animation, have inspiration, albeit not sentient. I'm an eccentric. I talk to my plants. Why not? It's not gonna. But I do think that it makes a difference, and I do include them in my psyche. I believe that this is my own belief that what I include in my own soul may go with me. C.S. Lewis said that. Could this be because the intuitive feeling function in our culture, collective culture, is typically ignored with the rational function being thought of as superior? And that doesn't mean we shouldn't have rationality. I mean, this has been a great thing. Bernstein offers repair to this dissociation, as I said, as participation mystique, alongside the development of a co-evolutionary relationship between ego and self, in which the ego takes on more strength, danger, 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 and becomes more equal to the self. The diagram for this relationship is similar to ego Edinger's stage 3, with the exception that the strong, bolded boundaries of the ego have a divorce between them. He says we will do better by investigating more in consciousness raising. I would add that such consciousness raising inevitably involves greater attention to our rites of passage, to the liminality of ritual, and to symbolic values over and above our own images in the phases of liminality. And get back to this images thing, which we're really going to work on tomorrow. We can think of the effects of the overinflated ego on globalism. That is, the spread of democracy, the internet, the universalization of information, global corporate bodies. The collective finds a projected image of totality, but I think it prematurely identifies with it. Hey, we've got it all. And I am no way saying that it isn't great that we have these discoveries. We have MRIs. We have things, advances in medicine. I'm in no way am I saying that. But I'm just saying the balance. Jung warns that behind such premature identification that we think we've got the wholeness really going here, is a false ideal, and the shadow, that there's a shadow of fear of unconscious content. Let me say that again. There's a fear, the shadow of fear against unconscious content. And I would say that above everything else I say tonight, that I'm going to stick to that is just about the red thread of what I'd like to leave with you tonight and take home. My own mentor, Anne Ulanoff, wrote an article on this 30 years ago, The Fear. She's of the Christian tradition. She wrote on the fear of the Christian unconscious, one of the best articles I've ever read. And, you know, it's basically ignored today. It's a very heady article. But it, even if you read parts of it, it's ignored. I think there's a great, whether we call it fear or just disinterest, or I don't want to talk about Yunga Bungo. I mean, who is this guy who's, I mean, people get the wrong impression. What does he, tarot cards, or, you know, didn't he have some nervous breakdown, or, you know, he gave up his academic position? I mean, what kind of nut would do that? Had 5 kids and went off with some mistress. I mean, yeah, let's face it, there have some things to confront. Because of the ego's hubris, it's believed itself to mirror the completeness of the self. Yet, the ego is actually enacting a shadow element from this position and is in identification with the self. When the ego identifies with the self, the shadow of wholeness, it's a little tricky here, the shadow of wholeness remains in an aerobic, undifferentiated state, as in the image of the collective mass mind. And let me just take that back to our stages of liminality where we're not affecting any change. It's not a transformative ritual. And what are we going to do to make any difference there? This is where it gets really serious. I don't want to send you all home depressed, but this is where I think there's a difference to be made. When the concept of the self becomes secular in this way, the global movement is merely presenting a pseudo-relationship to the self. If we become lost in this, it's great to participate in it, but if we become lost in this age of information, we reflect nothing more than the desire to eliminate the soul, the anima, of the world and to activate a process of dissembling the self. This greatly fears me on all levels, environmental, all across the board, with peoples, with genocide, with school shootings, you name it, the news. Dissembling the self is most unfortunately a theme in some of our postmodern literature, where the function of the self becomes more of a symbol. Now, symbol's not bad, but it's not acting as a bridge to something beyond it. Remember I said it's got to move beyond it. It doesn't stop with the self. Yeah. The self. So we're stopping with the self as a symbol, and we're not allowing it to, who said this, that the self knows about, and I'll just use the word God because that's what she used, the self is that which knows about God and that God knows about us. So whether you believe in God or some other spiritual something, the mystery of the universe, forces in the universe, something else, or nothing. I mean, whatever your spirituality is, it's still a spirituality. And this is what, it's not serving as a bridge to that because it's being dissembled. It is as if Jung's warning is being ignored. It is, quote, a psychic catastrophe when the ego is assimilated by the self. The image of wholeness that remains in the unconscious and shares the archaic nature of the unconscious. That's in CW 9, paragraph 45. This totality undermines the whole value of liminality and its symbolic resonances. And also, let's mention the transcendent function here. Here, the transcendent function of change and growth won't occur because there are no opposites to be placed in tension with each other. If we're identified with the self, where are the opposites? Again, it goes back to liminality. In liminality, we have opposites. We have conflict. We have two something that needs to be worked out together. That's how we are as human beings from the day we're born. None of us are so perfect that we have it all worked out and all the threads put together. We need the opposites. We need otherness. On the other hand, we don't want to remain in a constant state of otherness where we're marching in, can I say what we said last night, Tom? Where we're marching in 1960 for one thing and then we're marching, do you mind if I say that? Marching anti-Iraqi wars and this thing, and we're marching and we're advocating and we're still advocating and we're still doing the same thing and things aren't changing. So we need the transcendent function. We need the possibility. It's such a marvelous function we've been endowed with as human beings. The Ouroboric serpent that continually swallows its tail contains only itself. Without the mediating symbol of liminal phases between libidinal instinct and culture, the projected superpersonal value which has become withdrawn from its religious container will be reprojected onto some secular or political movement. When religious energy is applied to a secular object, we have a spurious, unconscious religion, as we see in so many fundamentalisms of today. Isms, 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 isms. Ideologies. And not just religious, but a lot of isms. I'd like to call this, this is my own term for this, transpersonal dissociation. In contrast to the notion of liminality of the transcendent being a significant factor in the process. So, can the ego at this stage of evolutionary development truly allow consciousness to be mediated by a transpersonal dimension on an experiential level not under its control? Remember, in liminality, there's a period of time we're in seclusion. We surrender. It's the unknown. We drop. However this happens, however these rituals of liminality happen, and they can happen in thousands of different ways. Little ones, bigger ones, group ones, solo ones. I emphasize the element of the experience of dying or already having died symbolically, inherent to liminality, which symbolizes a dissolution of the person we've thought ourselves to be. In order to break out of the security of Ouroboric harmony, we must encounter the experience of the death process, symbolically, in psychic depth, and also the dissolution of our familiar worldview, which many of us do in midlife, but I think we continue to, I certainly know mine is practically reversed from when I was 19 years old. In the death of the familiar self-image and the destruction of the world image, I'm not talking about the other kind of apocalypse. I'm talking about a symbolic apocalypse. We have a metanoia. Not many people know the word metanoia. Big change, major change that makes room for self-regeneration. Perhaps the words of William Harman, social scientist, resonate here, and this is cited in O'Callaghan, 1982. Our hope, I love this quote, our hope, our belief, is that it is precisely when society's future seems so beleaguered, when its problems seem almost staggering in complexity, when so many individuals seem alienated and so many values seem to have deteriorated, that it is most likely to achieve a metamorphosis in society's growth toward maturity, toward more truly enhancing and fulfilling the human spirit than ever before. And that's where I'm going to end for tonight. Now we have 15 minutes for, I know this was pretty heavy material, this last section. So take your time and you may just want to reflect or speak. Yes.
Well, I was just curious, you know, about the term you used, saying the self of being dissembled.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I can quite grasp that. To me, it just seems like the self is the self, and that I just assume, you know, the ego can't really alter its structure. But I was just curious if you could maybe elaborate on what you meant by that.
Mm-hmm. I was following some of the postmodern thinking on that, specifically Bernstein's, because it's primarily his idea, and others, quite a few others, unfortunately, whose names I won't mention, who are so against some of Jung's traditional ideas, and certainly, I mean, there are a lot of things about Jung that can be updated. I mean, after all, but I think some of the traditional things need to stay the same. And the dissembling of the self is coming, in essence, because of what he's saying about the ego identifying with it. So when the ego identifies with it, it's kind of absorbing it. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yes, it's the inflation. So in other words, our hero journey that used to be more the vision quest and the transformative potential, instead of that, it's turning into kind of an inflation. Hey, I've got this now, and so I can go out and have a power complex, and I can achieve a corporation, and I can be a CEO, and I can develop new software. And not that everybody, I'm not saying everybody's like that, but you get my point.
Yeah. I remember Edinger saying something similar to that. He said when the God image is lost in a culture, yes. Like maybe when Nietzsche made some of his comments, that someone was saying, maybe Edinger, that was indicating that there was going to, that energy that was using being projected onto that God image was then going to either result in like an overinflation, you know, within individuals, or it would be projected on something maybe inappropriate.
Right.
Like I think you mentioned, like secular.
Secular,
like,
exactly.
Like brands and corporate
branding, right.
Or athletes or something.
Right. Which is okay as long as it doesn't take the place or absorb the other.
But from what I'm gathering you're saying is that that's actually occurring.
I think so. Do you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that's the brown nose.
No.
I'm just
you're not, don't worry.
I'm coming from a different orientation. I don't understand what you're really talking about in ego, because I'm more used to either superego, ego and id, or parent, adult, child, and I'd sit there saying, well, the ego in my mind is really also the self, so I don't understand what you're really including in the ego versus the self.
So you're coming from a Freudian perspective?
Well, not really. I'm more Adler and others, but
still coming from a drive theory. Yeah, let me see if I could. Well, I won't take the time to draw it. Okay, so yeah, we have the superego and the ego and the id. And the id is the all the irrational unconscious. And the ego is what's mediating that from the superego, which can come down and attack or create projections and
So cultural attitudes of where you're supposed to act.
Right. So coming from that perspective, then, I understand why you wouldn't understand this. It would be kind of really foreign. So how would you see change occurring, and would you see any contemporary problems in that?
If I see the adult or the ego, then seeing problems with either parental controls or society, and then mediating a solution that answers the question of how they solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or a change in different, and what we call it, a change in his lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very practical and very valuable. I think I teach a course in psychoanalytic tradition, and I think all from Freud to Adler to Lacan to Sella, I mean all Winnicott, I mean all the great people who were the fathers, along with Jung, of the psychoanalytic tradition, have given us something, and these are very valuable suggestions. I question, because I'm going off in a very specific thing with Jung's hero's journey, so that may not relate as much. But your suggestions, you know, Freud was about life, love, and work, and let's find practical solutions, drive theory and Adler, to find that. And certainly we can do more with parental control, educational. I think education is extremely important. Starting young with groups for parents on how to raise children. I hear my clients all the time say, well, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get my son to sleep. And they read 5,000 paperback self-help books. And so I still think that even with parental control, and the child, just a little sideline here, that the child, on the contrary, a young child between 1 and 3, according to Winnicott, let's say, who comes out of drive theory and Adler, believes that the child should become at one point in a developmental state and omnipotent. That's a healthy stage. You just don't stay there. Yeah. And the mother allows that child to be ruthless. It's called, and through that, the child develops a capacity for concern for the mother. And then Winnicott takes that so far to develop concern for culture. It's one of my second favorite theories, next to Jung, because I think both Jung and Kohut and others fit very well with some Jungian theory. But what you're saying is valid. It's very valid. It's a different, coming from a different perspective, and I appreciate you sharing that.
That's where I'm trying to understand your perspective better on what the ego is in your terms and self.
So in Jung's terms, the ego is actually what we call a complex. The ego is not the same as it is in Adler's terms. At all, it's a complex. It's not front and center, although we think it is. I'm Catherine, and I, you know, this is how I relate to the world with my persona and my ego. But I'm really not. What this is all about is my alignment with something beyond me that's perhaps mysterious or transcendent, which Freud doesn't really have because he doesn't believe in that. This is where Freud and Adler would stop, and this is not a criticism, it's just a fact, that they do not go beyond to a transcendent factor. They have the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious, which is where they agreed. But that's where Jung and Freud went and had a horrible split that I mentioned that Jung went off and... they were like father and son, and they split over that very factor that Jung believed it was psychic energy and that there was something beyond and mysterious. And Freud says, uh-uh, I'm getting rid of my piano. I don't believe in this. This is how it is. It's life, work, and these are the three principles. So the ego is front and center. It's a different perspective. Doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just different.
So you're attaching it more to a religious concept of God?
No, not necessarily religious. Jung is sometimes misequated with religion. He had a minister father, but he sometimes overlaps with religion where he shouldn't. But he is implying... maybe not theological, just something else that's beyond the psyche. Let me put it that way. Something beyond the psyche that Hillman would say, but a whole different archetypal psychology, that the psyche doesn't live in us, which is what Freud would say, but that we live in the psyche, which is really something to ponder on.
Question.
So yes. I'm surprised not to hear anything about alchemy, because for me, what is constructive description, what to do during liminality period, is to go through alchemy process.
Yes.
Because there is no way you can get out if you don't go. I mean, you can't transform yourself if you don't go through this process. But you never mentioned it. really a bit strange. And one more is you talk about linearity as periods of time. Mm-hmm. We don't have tradition of linearity. For example, yoga, Indian yoga, is linearity of lifetime. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or for example, Buddhist Zen, right? Mm-hmm. For example, master can beat their students. And they keep them in state of linearity for their whole life. Mm-hmm. So, and we don't have this tradition in the West. So basically, what I don't hear is what is our approach to progressive linearity, how to use linearity constructively during our whole life.
Well, first of all, I think you've mentioned two excellent things, and I didn't go into alchemy. I did have some of it in my notes, but it was getting too long, so I cut a lot of it out. But that would have been a whole other paper. But very, very important. And Edinger, of course, has a great book on the alchemical process of what I've been talking about here. I actually spoke to him on the phone about a month before he passed away, and this was early on, so I don't think he was quite confronted with some of the things that we have been these more recent years. But I do think what he had a hold on was the alchemical process is an incredible analogy to periods of growth and liminality, and then your point on yoga or any traditions, and I didn't mention clerical traditions or yogic traditions, meditative traditions, people who enter convents or become monks or become Buddhist, Tibetan monks are profound. The Hindu cultures, the Buddhist cultures, that they're but one thing I notice is they're sometimes marginalized and often persecuted.
No, my main point is linearity must be supported consciously by a person forever,
yes,
their whole life.
Yes.
Here in the West, we don't have even a goal like this. We don't even understand all this.
Good point. Very good point.
And I think we need to borrow from the East and as far over as, because there's a lot. Jung didn't believe so much in that. I think he probably would change now, perhaps, if he were still alive. But there's so much to borrow in terms of how to, I'm just thinking of the Russian Orthodox Church, for instance, in terms of the symbology. That's why he liked the Catholic Church so much. Doesn't mean he was religious. He was not Catholic. He was not that kind of religious person. It was more the symbols and how the symbols led toward transformation.
I think there might be a bit of that, though, in an evangelical tradition of mm-hmm. like your walk with Christ or mm-hmm. your relationship to God,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of that being an ongoing luminality.
Very much so.
Constantly
yeah.
in communion with the divine throughout your life.
Mm-hmm. The evangelical traditions are the fastest moving traditions in the world right now. Throughout Africa, South America, America, at least that's the last statistic I read in the New York Times.
It should be Gnosticism. You know what Jung would say? It's Gnosticism. What is the tradition for a lifelong luminarity? Gnosticism. He would say this. He wouldn't choose Catholic Church or, as you said, Evangelist Church and so on. He would say Gnosticism.
Would say what?
Gnostic. Ah. You think he would say what was the Gnostic tradition?
Well, he was Gnostic, right?
No.
Jung was Gnostic, right?
No. No, I wrote a whole book on that. No. No. Gnosis, yes. Capital G, Gnosis. He's often confused because he borrowed. He went back and borrowed from the alchemists, you know, in the medieval times. He borrowed from the early Gnostic tradition, the notion of pleroma and creatura and the whole mythology of that. But no, he was. That's a whole other lecture. Maybe you'll invite me back to lecture on that one. We have a really good discussion on that. Robert Siegel has a good book on this. It was written quite a while ago. Mine was written a few years ago, called Dark Light of the Soul, and it's it addresses quite not totally fully, but quite a bit of the fact that it's very much a misunderstanding that Jung was a Gnostic. There will be people who disagree, but I think if we had a conference on that, I'd have a few words to say. No, he was not. And any of you who say you're Jungians, he'd say, forget about it. He said, don't be a Jungian. I'm not a Jungian. Yes?
You mentioned an article by Anne Ulanov.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about the Christian fear of the unconscious.
Yes.
Could you give the reference for that? I'd like to look it up.
What? It is in a journal. I could email it to Tom if you can post it on the website. I don't have it with me. I'm trying to remember what journal it was in, but I can I'll remember too. 30 years ago, but I think it's very relevant today. You know, that's a good question, because Anne does so many books where she's... Actually, I think it is. Actually, I think in one of her later books, she put it in. I'm not sure if it's the full version. By the way, Anne is retiring this year. She's one of my closest colleagues, and just so you know, we're going to have a big celebration for her soon. So she's been a marvelous contributor to the Jungian field, and I'm sure will continue to be. Just had to throw that in because I think very highly of her. But I will. I'll send that to Tom for the yes.
So on this topic of lifelong liminality, I was asking you at halftime. Actually, I feel like I'm in a liminal stage, but I haven't got any destination that I'm going to because I've finished a divorce basically, and I've quit drinking. I was a lifelong alcoholic, but. Because of my work that I do, I record a lot of activist groups, including, you know, anti-war groups, the Occupy, and so on, and on a weekly basis, it's on my YouTube page. And we all kind of know that there's no destination, and we're not going to change the country or anything, but it's more like a state of being an activist. I mean, before I did video about 5 years ago, I stood on overpasses with signs, you know, get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan. More than 500 times, usually with friends. And we knew by middle 2003 that we're not going to change the country and make them get out of Iraq, you know. And so why the hell are we doing this? Well, nobody quit. Well, a lot of people did quit, but the ones who are there, you know, are now my broader community of some hundreds of people. We know each other, you know. Oh, you came to this one too, you know. But isn't that kind of... what I'm saying is... the model that I'm living in is that you're... You know, there's a liminal stage where something falls away and then it doesn't get replaced by anything.
Or it takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe people went to racism and died before anything moved.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The Wall of China.
The Wall of China, the East Berlin Wall. And then one could say, well, there is no time, but we do live in time. Mm-hmm. And I really have no answer for... I mean, how could I have an answer for that, really? Other than to say it is, and it's unfortunate. And I do think it's a state of humanity. I'm not sure what the purpose is. Although I was mentioning to someone during the break that I think there is some... understanding of suffering as human beings that we are supposed to have that perhaps we haven't quite accepted yet. And I'm not saying people should suffer sadistically or masochistically or anything else, but that there's something to do with this liminal phase, and we don't necessarily know how long it will take. We don't know how long individuation will take. We don't know if it will ever happen. But we do as much as we can. And what Jung does say is that it's so simple, that each of us has responsibility, but we have ourselves. We have ourselves. We can't speak for the whole world or all of China or all of, but that's a beautiful point. It's true. Yes.
Well, just to build on that, maybe that is the action of self-energy or self-archetype on the human experience, that if we can be humble enough to maybe even say, we don't know what the better solution is. We don't know where we're going, but we're showing up, and we're doing whatever part we have to do. Maybe that's the self, in many terms, that's the self acting upon or knocking on the door or something, saying, "Hey, don't forget." You know, if we're willing to listen and to be humble, to take the actions that we are moved to take, but also to know, I don't know what the best thing is.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing now doesn't seem very good. I don't know what the best thing is, because it seems like every time we come up with a solution that's sort of imposed, it leads to dictatorship or, you know,
more
leads to the problem. It leads to another problem.
More dissociation.
Yeah.
And I'm going to address that tomorrow when we work on dream work and symbols and ritual a little bit more from a personal, just to give a hint for tomorrow, we're going to be doing collective dream work and building out of that, working with associative imagery toward symbols, and then seeing where those symbols lead or if they do. And kind of from this perspective, we may not have no answers, but to brainstorm, at least as a communitas here, one small group, well, we're not that small, but I mean one important group, to do the best we can do and to spread the word.
So we're going to have an opportunity to do something experiential.
Yes.
And we're going to have a chance to discuss.
Absolutely. Lots of discussion and lots of experience and some dream work. If you have dreams, bring them. If not, there'll be some meditative time to, if you don't remember your dreams, don't worry about it. We can work on a little of active imagination. And there'll be discussion time, too. So hope at 10.
It's 10 o'clock in this room, and we're going to go to 4.
Yeah. And there'll be breaks. Is there a lunch?
There's a lunch break.
Okay. Yeah, and I've asked people bring mats and blankets, and if it helps, we'll have lights off. There'll be some music for part of the thing. And if you have a sleep mask, I mean, if lights bother you or anything, if it just helps you to go really inward, because I'm going to be asking you to go inward for a period of time, not a long period of time, if that's helpful to you. And it seems like there was one other thing. You'll want to bring some paper and something to write with. Yeah.
I just had a question.
Yeah, please.
Do you feel that if we focus on the self and our own transformative processes and our own liminal states, that if everybody focuses on self, that collectively, we can transform as well, mm-hmm. as we do our individual transformations, so to speak? Do you think it has a residual effect collectively?
I definitely think that would have a residual effect. How to get everybody to, I mean, everybody may be a little broad, but I think, in respectfully so, I think the more that grows, the more that expands. And maybe our language will need to transform, because when you say self, sometimes people are going, What is, you know, we may need to translate, and I find it's always clear, direct, and in a way people will understand and not be frightened again, or, you know, will be able to accept that experience. It's accepting the experience in yourself. That's,
well, and you mentioned language too, because the importance of that, and also the religious context versus the secular context, and putting that language so that everybody understands and can put it into their own context.
Exactly. Very important. I think, well, we have time for a couple more questions? Okay.
My fear, though, is correct, sadly, I think you are. The ego has gotten so inflated. I think the more inflated the ego becomes, the harder it is to let go of surrender.
Surprises you. Frightens. Oh yes, I don't blame you. I don't blame you. It is frightening. It's extremely frightening. And as I said, I think that's one of the primary red threads I'm saying here, because if that's not somehow modified by some of the things that have been said about the self, you know, getting more out about the self through people's experience so that they understand and that they can reflect the inflation, then we might have an opportunity to change. But I'm quite serious that I think we're at a real crossroads. Yeah, and there was one other. We'll take one. Were there two? Okay, two more. All right.
When it came up about protesting and going to being an activist and all that, maybe there were some things that you had said or themes I got out of your talk, like the transcendent function will or won't occur, and how you just had like a breakdown of like you keep identifying with the other, like constantly identifying with the other, like the oppressed other, that we're like in another country or in another group or even ourselves, and then versus identifying with what's in ourselves and our shadows, and just thinking there's got to be a balance, like it can't just be on the march completely, like maybe activism, but you also got to have some of your own inner demons and shadows that you're working with that too. And that's what I got. Not to be a teacher's pet, but I feel like I got that from what you were saying.
Again, important point, because if we don't have our own inner life constantly engaged, I call it the coming from one of the most progressive seminaries probably around, I call it the shoulders up activism, and that's kind of an ego activism. The ego says, okay, I got it now, we're going to go out and we're going to do this, versus, you know, the real work I'm talking about is work. It's that at least some kind of process, whether it's yoga or whatever, to and I know they offer courses here, you know, an ongoing something that promotes your internal life of interiority so that you have something to come from, which deepens. That's going to challenge the inflation. That will challenge the inflation. And we have the Young Society and great leadership, and this is a great group of people. You're so intelligent, and I just want to thank you for being so articulate and engaged in the subject. I know the second part was a little intense, and yet I chose to do it because I was told how brilliant you all are by some of your leadership. And so I thank you for this opportunity to be here.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.